The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The following program is sponsored by Cleveland Right to Life and is responsible for its content.
Welcome to From the Median, a daily report from the front line of the pro-life movement, discussing two worldviews that are driving our culture in opposite directions. From the Median asks, which side of the road are you on? What direction do you want our culture to go? Tune in as we plan the route that takes us back to the culture of life. And now your host, Molly Smith.
Good evening and welcome to From the Median, where we are concerned with the middle ground, not just to understand both sides of an argument, but also to awaken the consciences of those who are neutral or indifferent to this, the greatest civil rights movement of all times, the pro-life movement. This evening we continue our Bringing America Back to Life series. Tonight we will feature a presentation from our 2023 convention. Our speakers' ideas will inspire you with principles, experiences, and wisdom as they join us to pave the way back to life through prayer, action, voting, and education. I am pleased to introduce to you Carrie Gress, a fellow at the Washington, D.C.-based think tank and a scholar at the Institute for Human Ecology at the Catholic University of America. She has a doctorate in philosophy from the Catholic University of America and is the editor of the online women's magazine, Theology of Home. Carrie has written for numerous publications, including the Catholic World Report, National Review, The Federalist, and many more. Carrie has lived and worked professionally in Washington, D.C., and Rome, Italy. Her work has been translated into 9 languages. She is the author of numerous books, including The Anti-Mary Exposed and Theology of Home. She co-authored City of Saints with George Weigel. She is the mother of 5 homeschooled children. Her latest book, Theology of Home 3, informs her talk, Reclaiming Woman in Head, Heart, and Home.
Goodness. Thank you so much. It's really a joy to be here. I had to laugh, actually, when I walked into this room a few hours ago. I think Austin Roos was speaking, and I looked at the background, and I thought, I'm wearing the same colors in my dress as the background. So anyway, hopefully I'm not too camouflaged. The nice thing is when things like this happen, you remember someone's talk better. So a year from now, someone will say to their husband, do you remember that woman, Carrie Gress? She said that one thing, and he's like, who's Carrie Gress? She's like, remember that woman that was camouflaged, the background at the conference? And the husband will be like, oh yeah, I remember who that woman was. So in any event, hopefully what I have to say will be slightly more memorable than this funny wardrobe malfunction. But what I really want to talk about this afternoon is where the pro-life movement is going. And I think, you guys have been at this for 2 days, but hopefully I'll be able to give you some new insights and things to think about, because I've got brand new research and products and projects that I've been working on. I've got a new book coming out in August that I want to share some of the research with you about. But of course, In saying all of this, I want to underscore what obviously a dream it was to have Roe v. Wade overturned. I'm almost 50 years old, so I never believed that would actually happen in my lifetime, and I still just pinch myself about it. But the problem is, of course, that we still have an awful lot of women getting abortions. We can change the laws. We can change politics. These are important things. We can pray an awful lot, all important. But what I really want to talk about is this new frontier of how it is that we can approach women, how it is that we can help women to not have to enter into abortion clinics anymore. So I'm going to do three things. The first is I want to tell you a little bit about myself and the process that I went through to arrive at these conclusions. The second thing I'm going to do is explain really what has happened to women. I've had the opportunity to dive back deep into feminism, almost kicking and screaming because it was a lot of pain and work. But back to the early days, 1792, and really pinpoint what the problem was with feminism and how it's led us down this path, where all the things that we're seeing now, you could actually predict based on where they started. So that's the second thing. And then the third thing I want to do is talk about this new idea, this new frontier that I think we can move to help women. So for those of you who we're here for Austin Roos's talk, you will understand that I am a radicalized mom. Thank you. I've been doing it a little bit longer than a year and a half, though. I wrote my first book, The Anti-Mary Exposed, it was published about 5 or 6 years ago. So I've been looking at these issues for quite a while. But I grew up in Oregon, one of the most liberal states, in fact, probably the most liberal state in the United States. And I will say, it was Eugene, Oregon, actually, which is at the time was known as the marijuana capital of the United States. I think now it's a different drug has taken over, but the Grateful Dead would show up every summer. I still can't look at a tie-dye and think it probably smells like patchouli and body odor because of my childhood. But in any event, I was pro-choice for a little while, for about 6 hours. I was in the sixth grade, and I had just learned what abortion was. And all the girls in my school thought it was amazing, that it was this great thing that we all had to get behind and be behind. And so I went along with them. I'd never heard of it before. I didn't know at all what it was. And then Dad got home and explained to me what abortion was, explained why we were pro-life, and that's just all there was to it. And it was amazing because it was the first time I had really had to swim against the stream and really learn how to, do something difficult and stand up to people that I respected and appreciated and liked, and to know that I had to do something different. So I then, also in Eugene, not everything was awful in Eugene. There was a woman in Eugene that was this amazing woman. She had 5 daughters. And they had grown up, and she spent every day in front of the abortion clinic near the campus of the University of Oregon when I was growing up. This is long before 40 Days for Life. This is the 1980s, 1990s. You just knew Terry Iannora was going to be out there in front of the abortion clinic, rain or shine, and most of the time it was raining because it was Eugene, Oregon. And she was just, she persevered like nobody I'd ever seen in my life. It was really phenomenal to witness as a young woman. And finally, the abortion clinic closed. And she got a reprieve for a couple years, and then another one opened. And what did she do? Same thing. Terry was back. And I think she did that until the day she died. She was so committed to that. And that was just a great thing for me to witness as a young woman. So I finally left Oregon, and I went to go do a doctorate in philosophy in Washington, D.C. It was a very circuitous route, but that's where I ended up. And I quickly discovered that there are a few things you can say to stop a conversation more than saying, I'm doing a doctorate in philosophy. This is an absolute conversation stopper. Some people have great jobs. Like, I'm a flight attendant, that's an entry, a way for people to be interested in what you're saying. And, I would go to the hair salon and say, oh, I'm getting a doctorate in philosophy. And you could see in their eyes, like, I have no idea what that is, but I'm just going to say, that's so interesting. And then we would move on to something else. There was never a conversation about philosophy, or you would get the kind of armchair philosopher, like, oh, I've heard of Nietzsche kind of thing. Which, of course, was not the philosophy that I was studying. But my favorite exchange was with a hairdresser whom I'd never met before, and it was the first time he was cutting my hair. And I told him I was doing a doctorate in philosophy, and he stopped and said, oh, wow. And then he said, can you believe that Lindsay Lohan just dyed her hair? And, of course, I didn't know who Lindsay Lohan was. So It was one of these things where we were completely talking past each other. Of course, I figured out who she is now and what a big deal it was, because I've seen Parent Trap 1,000 times with my children. But she had this red hair that I think she dyed it blonde. But it was one of those moments, and, you know, we all have them with our family members who are like, I just can't talk to these people. I don't know what to talk to them about. And so talking about doing a doctorate in philosophy was really a great way for me to realize, like, I have to find a different way to talk to people so that I'm engaging them. You know, I was still single, live by myself. You have to have community. You have to know people. You have to have, you know, people that you can talk about life with. And so I learned very quickly to not talk about my doctorate in philosophy and talk about food. Everybody loves to talk about food. Even, you know, barbecue. You can go stretch the whole, any social class. People have something about food that they love to talk about. So that became my kind of default conversation. And, you know, thank God for the Food Network, because people know a lot about food now. So I ended up, after I was almost done with my doctorate, I still had my dissertation, a few other requirements, but I was done in Washington, D.C., and a very wise woman said, if you ever want to get married, you have to leave D.C. And I wanted to get married. So I left Washington, and of course, God has a sense of humor, because where did I end up? Rome, which every American that I knew was a priest. So I thought, seriously? This is not going to go well. But one of those priests, someone who, a few of you might know who he was, Father James Flanagan, the founder of SOLT, what happened to be my spiritual director for a short period of time. And one day, and I will say this is really where I was radicalized, but one day we were meeting and he looked at me and he said, abortion will end. We will end it, or God will end it. And we won't like the way God ends it. And I really took that to heart. You know, up to that point, I hadn't really thought about women and abortion all that much. I had actually, as a doctoral student, said, I will never work on women's issues. Again, God has a funny sense of humor, because now it seems like that's all that I'm doing. But in any event, I knew I had this doctorate, and I thought, or I had this training, I thought, this is great. I can start using reason and logic to start winning over women for the pro-life cause. Anyway, we, as most of you know, actually live in a very post-reason culture, and making logical arguments just doesn't go well when you're trying to win women over to the pro-life cause. So I got incredibly frustrated, because I thought, I've studied all these years, I have all these arguments, I know what to say, I know how to make a logical argument from point A to point B to point C, and they just fell on deaf ears. And so I spent a number of years really trying to figure out, how do I reach women? What do I say to them? What is it? And, you know, one of the things that I stumbled upon is this, there's one thinker, he was a sociologist back in the 30s, and he was agnostic. He didn't really have any special commitment to faith of any kind, but he studied 80 civilizations. His name was J.D. Unwin, U-N-W-I-N. And he studied all these civilizations, and he said he finally got to the point where he realized they all reach this one spot. Every civilization reaches this one spot, and once they hit that one spot, then everything collapses. Well, what was that one thing that he found? It was the end of premarital sex. He said, when we got rid of premarital sex, that's when we lose monogamy, we lose faith, and we lose reason. So this is what I think so many of us are frustrated by, and I know I was frustrated by. It just seems so logical. How is it that you can think that it's okay to kill your child in the womb? So I still struggled with God and thought, how do I figure this out? Well, the first thing that I thought to do was, okay, I know how to research. I'm going to start looking into really the underpinnings, the philosophical underpinnings of feminism. And I wrote the book, The Anti-Mary Exposed. The subtitle is Rescuing the Culture from Toxic Femininity. And this book came out, like I said, 5 or 6 years ago. And then 4 days after Biden was inaugurated, Instagram and Facebook would no longer sell it on their marketplaces. saying that it violated community standards or something. And this was not a new book. I mean, there was nothing about this that was fresh. It just said toxic femininity, I think, and so they pulled it down. And of course, it was like the best thing that happened to this book was to get it canceled, because it just took on a whole new life. You know, I was all over Eastern Europe. I was on the front cover of Russia Times. It was just amazing how much attention this book got. So that was the first place where I started looking into feminism and to women and what's happened to women. And that book is available currently. But after I wrote that book, I had a lot of people saying, can you write another book that's secular, for secular women, to help them understand what's wrong with feminism? And so I decided to write one. And I didn't really know what I would find, because I wanted to go back earlier than the 1960s, because the 1960s is just this treasure trove of awful things, and the 70s. And it was easy to research. But going back to 1792 and Mary Wollstonecraft, whom I think I read her in college, but I had never read, hadn't read her since. It just sounded so painful and boring. But I did it. And I got, I think, a pretty amazing book out of it. It's called, it's coming out August 15th this year. Regnery Press is publishing it. It's called The End of Woman: How Smashing the Patriarchy Has Destroyed Us. And it's the kind of book that I can't believe it doesn't exist already, but I know that a man can't write this book because it would never get published. And I also know that a woman that has a degree, or I mean a tenure track or a career where she can be fired from, she could never write this book either. So that's the beauty of being a homeschooling mom, is it's pretty hard to fire me. So what were the things that I discovered? And I'm going to share some of it with you. It's, I mean, I could, we could be here for like 3 days of me telling you all this, the details that I discovered. But one thing that is foundational that I discovered in these early feminists, people like Mary Wollstonecraft, like I mentioned, but also Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, all these women that I think we hold on such pedestals, that I expected to find really lovely things that they wrote. And I was just amazed at what I did find. But what all three, all of them have from the very beginning, all feminist thinkers focus on, is first of all, this idea of restructuring society. And this is where that idea of smashing the patriarchy comes from, that we have to rearrange and restructure society so that men are no longer above women, is the argument. The second thing was free love. I was amazed at how much the free love movement and the end of monogamy was such a major component. You know, we think sort of back to the Victorian era, and there was nothing Victorian about these women. And the third thing was the occult. I was shocked at how much the occult was involved. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, she's got this table that's now in the Smithsonian, and it's it was basically part of a seance that she used, and that's where she came up with her idea for the Seneca Falls conference. But what all these women did, and you know, we also see this pattern in all these women, there's a lot of brokenness, there's a lot of pain that these women are dealing with, and rightfully so. I mean, some of the stories that you read about women's lives back in the, you know, 100 and 200 years ago are just, you know, will make you weep because of the things that women endured. But the solution these women, these broken women, saw was one thing. They all asked the wrong question, because they looked at women's lives and they said, these lives are really hard. And so their solution was, how do we make these women more like men? And I want that to just stick with you and think about that for the rest of your life, really, until abortion goes away, because this is the question that everybody is asking. And I'll refer to it again and make it clearer a little bit later. But the idea is, how do we get rid of women's vulnerability? And of course, a baby makes a woman vulnerable. And that's really where it all started. But one of the things that I found most fascinating in my research was really the connection between communism and feminism, which I don't think is really talked about all that much. You know, there are basically, again, these three pillars of feminism: free love, it's restructuring society, and the occult. Well, you could say that Marxism has this similar three pillars: restructuring society, free love, because they didn't care anymore about marriage and sexuality and the like, and atheism. So initially you have, you know, these three thing, these two groups that seem very opposed to each other. In fact, they hated each other. The communists thought that the women, the feminists, were too bourgeois because they were all wealthy women, and the feminists thought the communists were way too ideological. But slowly over time, you see this blending happening where the two are just melded into each other because they have the same goals and purposes to a certain degree. And you know, if you look at Soviet Russia, I talk about this a lot in the Anti-Mary, but if you look at Soviet Russia, you've got women who couldn't own, you know, a postage stamp size of land, but they could have an abortion any moment or any time that they wanted to. They could have, the idea was to make them the perfect workers so that they weren't burdened by children. You can see this. I've spent a lot of time in Poland, and I went to a friend of mine's home where he had lived as a child, and it was just one of these awful, ugly apartment complexes with all these different doors entering into it because the Soviets didn't want any common area for people to be able to congregate. So I went to his family's home, and his family's apartment was probably about as big as my hotel room is in this hotel. So they wanted to keep them small on purpose because people wouldn't have a chance to be able to have more children if you had very small space. The architecture was ugly. The children were all in childcare. So there were all these ways that they tried to just get rid of the family. So it was very much an easy fit with what was happening in feminism at the time. But in my research, I ran across this woman named Bella Dodd, whom I'm sure a number of you have heard of. She was a communist, part of the Communist Party. She was very, very active in getting the schools and unions in schools and trying to infiltrate communism into schools. And she eventually had this huge conversion at the hands of Fulton Sheen. And she, you know, much like Whitaker Chambers, those of you who know Whitaker Chambers, who was also a communist, that was able to leave the party and wrote that amazing book called Witness. She was able to leave the party and have this big conversion, and she was able to not be killed, which was actually a really hard thing to do because so many people that left the party had accidents or, you know, suddenly they just went missing or died. So Bella was, one of the other things that she did was set up this group called Congress for American Women, and this was in 1946. She set up this organization. It was a meeting for American women so that they could become more like Soviet women. And she writes in her book, Bella wrote this book called School of Darkness, explaining the reason why they started this group for women. And the main idea was really to get women to be on board with the Communist Party. And they thought that by talking about peace a lot, that that would be an emotional appeal to women, and then therefore women would really be on their side. But the bigger reason was also to recognize that American women do 80% of the family spending. This is something that the communists recognize. Women do most of the shopping. So they set up this Congress for American women so that they could sort of get the troops out saying how bad it is that women are shopping. So this group, the Congress for American Women, actually ended up being dissolved in 1950, this was before communism, I'm sorry, before McCarthyism, but it was one of those situations where it was just so obvious they were working in conjunction with the Soviets that that Congress had to act and just dissolve the whole group. But there were a lot of really influential women that were part of this group. One of them was the wife of the owner of Gimbel's, which was that department store that's featured in Miracle on 34th Street, I think, which you would think she would be for capitalism, given that they owned a department store. But in any event, there was a senator's wife. There was a woman named Eleanor Flexner, who's written this book called Century of Struggle, which is sort of the go-to book if you want to learn about women's suffrage, very much influenced by communism. And there was one other woman named Betty Friedan. And Betty Friedan wrote the book, of course, The Feminine Mystique, which came out in 1963. And Betty did an amazing job of selling herself as the average housewife. But there's a great book that was written by a man named Daniel Horowitz. And Daniel Horowitz was actually a friend of Betty Friedan's. He thought, you know, she had a short stint teaching at USC, and he saw Betty with some of the students, and he was like, she's teaching, like, communist tactics. Like, how does she know that? And so he asked her about it, you know, what's your background? And, you know, they talked on a friendly level about it, and she explained that she had been involved in some different things in college and at Smith College. And anyway, he was absolutely fascinated by the idea of telling the story of Betty Friedan as the communist, because he wanted to make it clear that McCarthyism hadn't destroyed the movement, the left, the communists, that she was one of the people that was able to come out on top despite what McCarthyism had done. So he wrote this book called Betty Friedan and the Making of the Feminine Mystique. Well, as soon as he told Betty Friedan that what he was doing, she wanted nothing to do with the project, of course. She said, you're not allowed to get into any of my private papers, which they're not going to be made available publicly until 2035. So he had to use open source materials, but he found just an incredible wealth of information about Betty Friedan, the communist. You know, she's back in the 30s and 40s. She's writing communist articles. She's writing about feminism. You know, all the things that she said she wasn't involved in. It's clearly on the page. So one of the things that Betty Friedan talks about, it's in chapter 9. I stumbled across it when I was reading her book, and it's very blithely thrown in there. Like, I was at the grocery store checkout line. I mean, it's not that blithe, but it's sort of that's the sense you get. And what does she say? I suddenly realized the significance of the boast that women wield 75% of the purchasing power in America. I suddenly saw American women as the victim of that ghastly gift, that power at the point of purchase. So what she's doing, she's talking about the 75% of purchasing power that women have. It's almost word for word exactly what Bella Dodd describes in her School of Darkness. Bella says 80% is the purchasing power. Friedan says it's 75%. But the point that she's making is to try and, exactly what the Congress for American Women was doing, was trying to dry up capitalism. But it gets more interesting, actually, because from her journals, one of her journals, somehow Horowitz was able to gain access to one in a library or something that wasn't private. She writes, "We see already that the emancipation of women and their equality with men are impossible and must remain so as long as women are excluded from socially productive work and restricted to housework, which is private. The emanation of women becomes possible only when women are enabled to take part in production on a large social scale and when dominant duties require their attention only in a minor degree." So this quote is from Marx. She's got it in her journals. And what is she doing in her books? She's describing how awful it is for women to be home, how terrible the home is. She actually uses the language, and I can't believe that this exists still, but she uses the language of the comfortable concentration camp is how she describes it. But she's doing more than that. She's also manipulating us. She knows that she's got a psychology degree, and she's going talking to women in that place in women's hearts that feels cheated or feels like a victim or feels like I'm not getting enough of something. And she knows exactly what she's doing with that, and that's really what drove so much of the interest in it. But what's really amazing is to compare her work and what motivated her to see women leave the home to those famous words that are in Auschwitz, "Arbeit macht frei," work will make you free. That's exactly what she's trying to say with her work, is that women will only be free when we are working. And what did women do? Well, we gobbled it up. She sold 3 million copies of that book in the first few years in English alone in the United States. And it was just this huge transformation that took place in society based on that Marxist ideal. So then we move ahead, of course, to the 1970s, and we realize that We've got people like Kate Millett. Kate Millett, probably few of you have heard of Kate Millett unless you've read my books. But Kate Millett was this sort of underground disaster. Kate died a few years ago, and her sister Mallory has become a friend of mine. Mallory had a big conversion in the middle of her life, and she's now feels incredibly guilty about all the things that Kate does, and she's trying to get the message out, and she keeps saying to me, thank you for writing these books, because I don't have to write them. But she talks about how Kate, you know, Kate was this engine of really trying to focus on taking the Marxist idea of the oppressor and the oppressed. Usually in Marxism, we see that as a class and economic struggle. She applied it to men and women. So men were naturally the oppressors, and women are naturally the oppressed without ever doing anything to be oppressed or oppressing or being oppressed. And she was very, very determined to see gender erased entirely in our culture. She would look at the Vietnam War and she said, you know, these men are over there killing innocent people. Women should be doing the same. We should be killing our babies. She thought we have to have the courage and the strength to do that. And people listened to her everywhere. She was a huge, huge deal. But she also was incredibly mentally ill. She was in and out of institutions. She was just an incredibly broken woman, but was hugely influential. But again, the goal here is to show that women can only be happy if we make them like men. That's the unspoken goal, or to get rid of gender altogether. And this is exactly what we're seeing. This is why abortion is so important to them, because the only way you can make women like men is if you have contraception, if you have abortion readily available at any time. Otherwise, we are women. And, you know, I think this is one of the reasons why we're seeing all this hate directed at crisis pregnancy centers, because they see it really is, they really firmly believe it is a kind of torture for a woman to have a baby, because they think women have to be like men. So the whole goal really became power instead of love and service. Women had to become, you know, and not even good men. They didn't want women to be like good men. They wanted them to be bad men, like the Mad Men, you know, just living horrible lives. So what does this bring us up to now? Well, here we are. We've got all these young girls who have been told that they have gender dysphoria and they need to have top surgeries, and in order to be happy, in order to not commit suicide, they have to become boys. I'm sure many of you have read the book by Abigail Schreier, who wrote... the name has totally escaped me. It'll come to me in a minute. But she wrote a book about this craze happening to young girls, which did not exist before 2008. It was completely a non-existent problem. And suddenly she pins it on smartphones. But I think it's also just a stretching out of this idea that women have to be like men. And she points out that these girls aren't trying to be like boys that, you know, go and ogle women and get weight sets and do things that boys do. She points out they just don't want to be women. They just don't want to be girls. And if you stop and think about that for a minute, it makes perfect sense, because for 50 years, we haven't said a good thing about being a woman. The only time we give women praise is when women are being like men. This is the culture in which we've steeped, all of us have been steeped in this culture. And these young girls are just the next logical expression and extension of that. So of course, you know, part of the real solution to this, part of the reason why we can't define what a woman is in this culture, is because we're so, so afraid of the M word, motherhood. We need to reclaim this. This is something that I think this problem is not going to go away until we start reminding women that they're mothers, and not just biological mothers, but psychological and spiritual mothers. We see this a lot with religious orders. You know, there's a reason why the leader of a religious order is often called mother. I have some nuns that I'm very close to that are cloistered, and I often refer to them as the mothers who mother mothers, because they offer so much consolation to those of us who are out raising our children. But what's, I think, really interesting, too, is to see the flip side of this, to see that we have this crisis of motherhood and of understanding of it. But at the same time, we also have right in front of us this very reality that women are starving to be mothers. Sadly, we can see this in the pet craze in our culture. We spend $700 million in the United States on Halloween costumes for our pets. $700 million for Halloween costumes for our pets. And it just is going up. So you see this thirst of women who have this incredible gift and this capacity and this love that they don't know where to go with. Because I know when I was growing up, no one had bumper stickers about loving their grand dog, or being a fur mama, and this is what we see very, very commonly. So how do we restore this? What do? We have this huge mess. The first thing we have to see is just the recognition that we are not engaged in culture at this point. The biggest problem is that we are making political and academic arguments often, but we are often not engaged in where women live in so many ways. One of the things that happened when a couple of years ago was that I was good friends with Mary Lisa Carney, whom most of you know. She's married to Sean Carney. She's featured in Unplanned. And Mary Lisa, this was long before the movie came out, and I said, "Mary Lisa, how did you help save so many babies?" And she said, "I just started talking to women, but I would start by saying, I love your shoes. I love your purse. Your haircut is lovely." She would say something that was very personal. And she said, I couldn't make it up. It had to be honest, because women can tell when you are lying. But she said that was what really was a way for me to enter into conversation with people. The other thing that happened that I noticed was when I went to have a baby, I was flipping through channels and I ended up on HGTV. You can't watch Food Network when you're having a baby because you can't eat anything. So it's just cruel to make someone watch Food Network when you're fasting. So as I turned this on, the nurse said, "Oh, every woman ends up on this channel. Every woman ends up on HGTV when she's laboring and delivering." And it was these kinds of things that started jumping out at me, where I started realizing, we don't have a magazine, a national magazine. If you go to the checkout stand, is there one magazine that you would look at where you didn't have to flip through pages very quickly because there was something that would either offend you or maybe your son behind you or daughter? We don't have magazines. We don't have daytime TV, book publishing. We don't have any. We have very few Hollywood movies that are geared towards women and towards what we're interested in. We don't have academia. And this is one of the things that I think I only realized how powerful this narrative is when you start looking at all of these different areas. And, I know it was talked about in the last talk about just how all of these institutions have fallen. But some of them were things that we could actually, could and can still engage in and still recognize. Because what we have to do is find the language of the women who are going into these abortion clinics. The language that they're speaking is not academic and it's not political. They just want to look at a magazine. They want to hear something from Gwyneth Paltrow. And it's amazing the pull and the tug that these lifestyle brands have, all of these products have on these women's lives. And I'm not saying that we could ever beat the left, that we could ever beat this narrative by trying to catch up with them. But the thing that I come back to when I feel like maybe we shouldn't do this at all is just the recognition that it's almost a miracle that we still have 42% of women who are pro-life. If you think about how powerful the narrative is, and yet we still have 42% of women who are pro-life, it's because they had family members or they heard from somebody somewhere. They had a woman who prayed in front of the abortion clinic that was their family friend that witnessed to them. But what if we could find a different way to bring the message to them that was our message, instead of it always being the left, instead of it always being ads for things that we're horrified by or lifestyles that we're horrified by? So rather than just complain about this, my friend and colleague Noelle Mehring and I actually decided to do something about it. I have 5 children. She has 6. I'm in Virginia. She's in California. And the first thing we did was write a book and start a blog. If you can hold up the book. I've got a few copies of these left. The book is called Theology of Home, Finding the Eternal in the Everyday. And I can hang on to it if you want to, Marty. Thanks. So we wrote this book, and it's a coffee table book. It's a gorgeous book. It shows families. We have it. It's full of what we call the forbidden pictures because men look competent in it. You never look competent in commercials. It has women who look happy. It has big families. It has pregnant women. It has all these images that you're just not going to see in a regular magazine. It's also beautiful. When we first got this book, I sent a copy of it to Joanna Gaines from Fixer Upper. And we actually got a letter back from her. It wasn't written in her hand, but it was her secretary saying how much she liked the book, which, you know, is like the gold standard to have Joanna Gaines from Fixer Upper, you know, like your book. So we knew we were onto something. But the other thing that happened, you know, we didn't get a huge amount of press, but this book sold like hotcakes. It's one of the top-selling Catholic books in the nation. It's currently being translated into Chinese, Lithuanian, Slovakian, and Spanish. I think it's supposed to be coming out. People have shown interest in French and Polish as well. And it's the book is our message. It's using the ideas of the left, but with our message and showing people what it's like. And, you know, I think the real power of it is, you know, we hear from people all the time. We hear people say, you know, I have taken my marriage more seriously. I don't have so much resentment for being home. You know, all of these kinds of things that women's lives are changing. We had another baby. All these things happen. And it's been amazing to see how this little book is changing women's lives. But of course, we didn't stop there. We also simultaneously had started a blog that's called theologyofhome.com. And Noelle and I knew we couldn't write articles every day. We couldn't keep up with regular secular media and write articles. We didn't have any money. You know, how are we going to do this? So we just started this aggregate site. So every day, women, you can go to our site 5 days a week and get 8 articles about things that you care about that we've already looked through to make sure that they're not going to be things that you're horrified that your son's looking at over your shoulder. Things that women are interested in. There's cooking recipes, there's travel tips, but there's also a lot of things about the church in there. So we're end up trying to help form women through these articles and to give them an avenue, that sort of magazine experience in a way that we can provide it. So we've also come out with 2 books since we came out with this one. One of them is called The Spiritual Art of Homemaking, and it really provides a new way for women to start thinking about themselves within the context of being mothers, of being women, because we don't have that grammar anymore. Women don't know how to define themselves. And so this book gives them really tangible and beautiful ideas about understanding ourselves as women. We also did a fun one about called At the Sea, which was just a great meditation on the ocean related to women. And then we have a 4th one coming out by another colleague of ours on flowers called Arranging the Seasons. That'll be out in October, and it is absolutely stunning. It goes through the whole January through December, but it's all those liturgical high notes, all those things that you can imagine doing throughout the seasons, and it's just beautiful. We also have a TV series in production. We're working with a production company in Tennessee. So we have all these things that we're trying to do, and of course we always laugh, like what could we really do if we actually had some marketing experience and we actually had some merchandising experience and we knew what we were doing. Because we've also started a lifestyle brand, which is what we're funding it with. We don't take any donations. We're a for-profit organization and we're managing to keep ourselves afloat. But the whole idea is, again, how do we speak the language that women need to hear? How do we give them the visuals and the kind of content that is going to transform them, that they're going to listen to, that we're not going to just talk past them by saying, I have a doctorate in philosophy, but in fact give them something really beautiful and rich and compelling that can transform their lives and their minds and their hearts. And I think this new frontier, this idea of trying to get back into whether it's magazines or movies or television, you know, we're we're figuring out some of it, but I think it's really important that we start doing more of it, and I think that this is the best way forward as far as how it is that we can keep women from abortion clinics and how it is that we end abortion instead of God. So, thank you.
Thank you so very much, Dr. Gress. So, folks, if you still have cards that you're filling out, go ahead and our volunteers are still coming around, but we have a good start here. And we have, it looks like, a little bit of extra time for questions. We'll take this until around 4:58. So we got about 12 minutes here. Dr. Gress, some good ones already. Why do you think feminists and women in general are silent about the sudden reversal of women's rights as a result of the trans movement, i.e. men in women's sports?
Mm-hmm. So I think the question is, why do I think they're not upset about men becoming women? Because it's a whole product. It's a whole project. It's the culmination of what it is that they've wanted, actually. It's, again, how do we get rid of gender entirely? So for them, this was the goal, was how do we make men like women, women like men? It's amazing to go back and look at Simone de Beauvoir has that line about, you know, a woman is not born, she becomes a woman, or I'm paraphrasing, but something to that effect. And how much that energized the trans community, even before, you know, the 60s and 70s. This was a very early thing, and this is what the trans community has taken on, is this idea of we can become women. You know, Simone de Beauvoir said we could become women because we're not born that way. So I think that that's what is fascinating, is to just watch and see, you know, how far are we going to let them take it? Because this is, again, the goal, the goal that they had from the very beginning. We want to get rid of gender altogether. So it's just the logical extension of what it is they've set out to do.
I'm going to interject one of my own questions here, only because I got an alert come across my phone a short while ago from the Daily Caller. I don't know if anybody else here follows that, but it's so pertinent. It was from 1:38 today about our Pope. Pope Francis declares gender ideology as dangerous to civilization. I know a lot of people have good and bad things to say about the Pope at various points in time, but I'll just read the quote, and I'd love your response to it, because it ties right into what you just talked about and also even that last question. Pope Francis explained, quote, all humanity is the tension of differences, end quote, and worried about how gender ideology had virtually eliminated those differences between men and women. Quote, why is it dangerous? Because it blurs the difference and the value of men and women. The question of gender is diluting the difference and making the world the same, all dull, all alike, and that is contrary to the human vocation. End quote. So this was literally a story
that
just came. Yeah, right?
Yeah,
that's it. That's a little bit uplifting to me, and I know a lot of other people as well. How do you respond to that, Dr. Gress?
Yeah, I think it's startling, and it's great to hear that. It sounds very sensible, and you know, I think the reality, too, is that it's not men and women. It's a family that they're really going after more than anything. And that's what, you know, broken people break people. So we can see this generationally, how it just keeps spanning out and making more brokenness. And that was really the goal from the start, was to break the family and then to make this neutrality. So anyway, I think it's great that he made that statement.
Yeah, I do, too. Let's hope there's an outgrowth from that. Okay, Dr. Gress, do you believe that a woman could be a Catholic feminist, or are Christianity and feminism mutually exclusive?
Yeah. I think that's an excellent question. It's such a hard question, because the problem is feminism has become a brand, if you think about it. It's huge. It just it doesn't really have a specific meaning anymore. If I say the word feminism, I probably mean something much different than what you mean. And then we have all these different shades of it. So the hard part is that most people don't think to actually define what they mean by feminism. Obviously, you know, John Paul II used the word feminism. Edith Stein used the word feminism. So it's a hard thing. And most of the research that I did for this book, of course, was secular feminism. So I didn't, you know, go into anything related to Christianity. But the problem is, again, the definition. And the problem is, feminism has so much baggage. Like, do we really want to hang on to this? Do we really, like, what it does, it seems like it just confuses a lot of women, because it's sort of like, well, which parts are you hanging on to? The smashing the patriarchy part, the occult part, or the free love part, you know. And obviously, again, I know that there are people that have done amazing work within Christianity and Catholics on feminism, but I think it's got so much baggage that it's just really hard for the average woman to be able to sort through all of these and figure out if it works. You know, it's sort of like saying, well, we're Nazi Catholics, you know. Like, there's a lot of baggage to the word Nazis, and everybody knows that, and they're not going to use it anymore. You know, and that sounds extreme, but feminism actually killed more people than the Nazis did, if you think about it, if you think about abortion and Hitler. So I think that we have to be really careful with words and with language. And so I don't use it anymore when I describe myself, because I just think it's way too confusing, and I think that there's... because it's a brand, it has a certain amount of appeal, and I understand why people use it, but I think it's just really dangerous at this point.
Thank you, Dr. Gress. This one was obviously a big part of your talk. Since women seem to understand more and more that work makes you free is false, why do you think it is that so many women still work outside the home?
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is a great question. I don't work outside the home. Well, I'm here. I work outside the home. One of the things that we have to keep in mind is just the nature of our families has changed. The nature of our finances have changed. You know, I don't have a cheap education for my children anymore, unless I do a lot of the homeschooling, and even then, it's still not inexpensive. There are those kinds of demands. There's also a huge change in what it means to be home. You know, I've thought a lot about the difference in just laundry. You know, if I'm doing laundry, I get it all together. I add the soap, I sort them, I push a button, and I walk away. You know, this was unheard of 100 years ago. And people worried about things like their Sunday best, you know, whether it was stained or it was smelly or it just didn't look nice. You know, we don't have that problem. Things get stained or smelly, we just can kind of throw them away and find something else and buy something else. So, you know, we're not canning. We're not, you know, a lot of people are going back to those kinds of things. But the average woman today isn't doing all of those things. And so there's a certain amount of time that we actually do have because I push a button on the washer instead of, you know, out there wringing it out. So I think that technology has certainly changed a lot in that respect. The other reality is that it is incredibly lonely being a stay-at-home mom these days. You know, the neighborhood that I live in, it's an older neighborhood. It's from the 60s. And there's still, I think, 3 or 4 families that were there from the beginning. And they talk about all the kids coming out and playing in the cul-de-sac, playing baseball, during the day. And we're like one of the only families in this neighborhood that has children. So there's not a lot of people that... We don't have the kind of community that we once had, and I think a lot of women are getting that community from work in a way that they normally would have gotten from their family that lived close by or from, you know, neighborhood kinds of things. So I think there's a lot of different pressures. Financial is obviously one of them, and then I think for myself, you know, would I rather be home with my family? Absolutely. Would I rather not have to work? Absolutely. But I also feel I have a vocation that God has formed me for something. So I think there's all kinds of reasons, and this is why spiritual direction and, you know, being deeply sensitive to what God is calling women to do is really vital instead of making blanket statements about what women ought to do.
You've been listening to Carrie Gress, philosopher, entrepreneur, prolific writer, and our presenter at the 2023 Bringing America Back to Life Convention.
From the Median is listener-supported. Visit our website, fromthemedian.org, for further information or to make a donation to continue to make this radio program possible. Email us, radionews@fromthemedian.org, or call 440-668-4049. Through our fromthemedian.org website, you can download this or previous programs for your listening pleasure or sign up to receive our weekly preview of upcoming guest interviews. Tune in every weeknight at the same time to listen to another great interview on From the Median as we plan the route that takes us back to the culture of life.
This program has been sponsored by Cleveland Right to Life and is responsible for its content.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.